ready to get serious about building content sites and building a profitable business online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online asset. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. Let's do this.
Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode of the Niche Website Builder podcast and YouTube video. This week I'm talking to Ricky from Income School. Ricky's been involved in making and teaching about websites for over 7 years now, so he's basically got a ton of experience. And today we really get into the weeds, talking about their keyword research methods and also their content creation system, you know, how they marry keyword research and content creation to create content that just works. I learned a ton from this episode, and I think you will too. Ricky's a great guy. He's very personable. He answers the questions in great depth and great detail. So I think you'll enjoy this one. So let's get into it.
This episode is brought to you by Niche Website Builders, an agency dedicated to helping people just like you build profitable content sites. Niche Website Builders are the hands-off content site marketing agency you always wished existed. It's run by content site marketers for content site marketers, and they help both investors and individuals alike build profitable online properties. They provide a fully outsourced approach to content creation, link building, and done-for-you website builds, the same approach they use on their own six-figure portfolios. For example, their content packages come with a proprietary keyword research process, are written by in-house native English speakers, formatted using templates proven to convert, and uploaded to WordPress with affiliate links added so that all you need to do is hit the publish button. Check them out at nichewebsite.builders/show. That's nichewebsite.builders/show and fill out the form to get coupon codes for 10% more content or a 10% discount on links with your first order sent right to your inbox.
Hey, Ricky, welcome to the show. How's things?
Great. Things are great. Thanks for having me.
No, you're welcome. And I know you've just been on an amazing trip down to sunny Mexico, right?
I have. Yeah, my wife and I got to take a few days. It was... I think overdue. We've been needing a little getaway. So it was nice, just the two of us.
When was the last time you managed to get away with all the COVID stuff going on?
Oh, it's been a while. This year, even with the whole family, we've hardly gone anywhere.
Yeah.
Probably 2 years ago, my wife and I got to take a little trip before COVID. And then we had our last baby, and he was born, and like a month and a half later, COVID shut everything down. So that's been it for us.
God, yeah, I can imagine that's been quite stressful there, to be honest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very much overdue. So you've come back nice and refreshed and ready to hit it hard again now, I guess.
I think so.
Awesome. Well, I mean, you're pretty well known in the space. But for some people some of our audience who may not know you so well, just want to give us like, you know, a couple of sentences about who you are, and we'll get into your background, but just, you know, kind of, who is Ricky? What makes Ricky tick? And just introduce yourself, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm Ricky Kessler. It's funny because I was Rick Kessler when I graduated high school and I went off to college. But when I started working, and we'll talk more about this, when I started working with Jim, he always knew me as Ricky. And so he called me Ricky on a podcast, and I've been Ricky again ever since. And I'm okay with that. I actually like that. It's just funny. I'm a dad. I got a family. I mentioned my wife. We have 5 kids. Wow. Our oldest is 10. Our youngest is almost 2 now. Yeah, that's most of my life right now. But I also enjoy sports. I'm a tennis player, or used to be. I haven't played much in a while. And the other thing that I just love is music. I play the piano. My kids are learning the piano. And just I love music. I sing, play, that kind of stuff. It's a big thing for me.
Well, that's awesome. I'm not very musically inclined. I actually have a funny story. It's an embarrassing story, but it's funny. So the first and only ever time I tried to learn a musical instrument was back in high school. And it was a trumpet. And I took it home for the night. And I didn't realize you had to blow it a certain way, right, for it to make a sound.
Yep.
I didn't realize that. Like, no, the teacher didn't tell me that. So I'd spent all night blowing this trumpet really, really hard, not the right way. And then I actually blew it so hard, I gave myself an hernia. So I was like 14 and I gave myself an hernia to have an operation. So that was the first and last time that I tried to learn an instrument, basically.
Yep. I was lucky because when I took home a trumpet for the first time, my dad showed me how, because he played in high school. And that was a game changer because I would have probably done the same thing. But he taught me how to buzz my lips and make a sound. And that made all the difference.
All right. So this question I like to ask, and it might be a long time ago now, but do you remember how you made your first dollar online? Because I think that's a pivotal point in people's lives when they make that first dollar. Do you remember what that was and how you did it?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's different for me than I would say most people, in the sense that my first experience, well, actually my first dollar online was selling leather bags. I was doing like an Amazon FBA before I even knew Amazon FBA was really a thing. I just had a friend and he was like, hey, we can buy stuff from factories across the world and sell it on Amazon. And I was like, oh, that sounds cool. And we did a little bit of that. So that was actually my first dollar. That was a couple of years before I actually really even learned much about the online space and started working with Jim.
Okay. Interesting. So it was like the Amazon, was it FBA or was it kind of drop shipping stuff? Oh, I guess if it's on Amazon, it would be FBA kind of stuff.
Yeah, it would have been FBA because we just ordered a bulk shipment and brought it over.
What happened with that? Just didn't work out? You didn't like that model?
Actually, the main thing that happened was the supplier just totally stiffed us. I mean, he was like, yeah, I need payment up front. And we're like, okay. And he's like, send it Western Union. We were like, no. So we'll send it via PayPal. And then he comes back a week later and says, great, I have everything ready to do to make your order, but it's actually going to cost twice as much now. And we were like, forget it. We'd gotten our first, small order from him and everything was fine. So we sold that stuff, but we're like, well, we got to find a new supplier. And next thing we knew, there were three other brands on Amazon selling the exact same bags from the same factory. And we're just like, you know what? This is going to be such a headache. Forget it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you made the right life choice, I think, because it's probably led you down a different path.
Totally.
Okay, so what did you do before you started income school then? Like, what's your background?
Yeah, I was a chemical engineer. I did that for a few years. And while I was working, I was also working on an MBA, a master's of business administration. Finished that, continued working with the same company. They moved me to Texas. I was living in Dallas, Texas. And it's funny, the move happened while I was working on my MBA. And I went to my graduation. The school I was through was actually in North Carolina, University of North Carolina. And I came back from graduation, and my first day back, the company laid me off. And I was like, okay, this is, and it was actually exact. It was like the best thing I could have hoped for, because we were just dying to move back to Idaho. We just love it there. It's where all of my wife and I's family is. And with the MBA and the company helping sponsor it, I had a 2-year obligation with the company. They didn't have to give me a raise. I had no option. I had to work for them or pay the money back. And instead, they let me go and said, and I was like, now, just to be clear, I don't have to pay you back, right? And they're like, oh, no, of course not. We'd never do that. I said, okay, this will be fine then. They gave me 3 months severance. I started my job at HP, the computer and printer company, 2 months later in Boise, Idaho. So I had a month of getting paid by both jobs. I mean, it was like the best thing that could have happened. A friend of mine that worked with me in Texas, the guy who actually was doing the Amazon stuff with me, was like super jealous, because he wanted to get laid off too, because he was in the same boat. You know, he wanted to try to upgrade to a new job, a better job. And, you know, the company's just holding on to him. So I had a good deal there. So yeah, I was an engineer. Then I worked in business, product management, and project management, both at HP, while I started Income School. And then once Income School reached that level where I could leave the job I did just a few years later.
Awesome. So you kind of got a free MBA, moved back to where you wanted to be, a month where you had double salaries. It was like a pretty sweet outcome.
I could not have planned that. It just was so perfect.
Awesome. So I guess while you're working at HP then, you started Income School with Jim. So, and I know you guys knew each other from school, but how did you reconnect? And then how did the whole Income School idea start? And when did it start? Like, how did that whole journey happen?
Well, the story and kind of where Income School comes from, it starts with Jim. When he was in college, he took a photography class. It was kind of the thing that he could do to let go, to let loose and do photography.
Yeah.
And he loved it. And then, so when he went off to law school, it just, a lot of things were really hard. They didn't have much money. You know, college student, just living on the other side of the country from his family down in Florida. And he was always the type to be doing something, to dabble in things. Even way back when we were in high school and stuff, when he wants to learn something, he's going to dive in and learn it. So, anyway, he started learning about blogging and online stuff, and he starts his photography blog. And it was very slow going, lots of trial and error, just figuring things out on his own. There weren't a lot of people teaching how to do it. He'd listen to people like Pat Flynn. He'd listen to entrepreneurship podcasts and stuff, and just kind of figuring it out. Well, a few years later, that turns into his full-time gig. It's going really well. Now he's starting other little sites and selling them and buying and flipping other websites and figuring out kind of his whole thing. And he decided there's nobody teaching this, at least not the way that I would want to teach it. So he starts this blog, Income School, and, you know, put some stuff on it. And within about 6 months, he realized, I can't do this and my photography blog. It's too much. I need a partner. I don't have the drive to follow this thing through on my own. He had started a podcast, but again, it just kind of, he ran out of time, stopped publishing. And, I had recently actually reached out to him. We'd connected, actually one time when I was home for Christmas, I ran into him, kind of a chance thing. And, we kind of reconnected. I learned more about what he was doing. And then in business school, I took an entrepreneurship class and I had to interview an entrepreneur, and I'm like, okay, this is going to be easy. I'm going to call Jim and spend an hour, do an interview and write my paper. We're good. But that might've been the thing that just, I was top of his mind. You know, he knew me really well and just kind of knew what my strengths were. And so he texts me out of the blue and says, hey, I got a business proposition for you. Do you want to talk? And that was kind of the end of that. He's like, we can share Income School. We'll start it up. I have a website, but that's it. I have a website with some content, a few episodes of a podcast. We'll pick it up from here. If you'll just write a bunch of content, we'll call it good. We're 50-50 and we'll take it from there. I was actually still in Texas. I hadn't been let go yet. So we start podcasting remotely. And back then there weren't as many like cool services like this. So literally we're calling through Skype and I have a Zoom recorder on my desk and he's using just a good mic in, you know, as an input to his computer. And I'm recording it, just through Skype, you know, no video, nothing like that. And anyway, that's how it started. So like the first thing I did with Income School was get on a podcast, which is like the scariest thing I could have imagined. And that's how it started. And then, and that was, I guess we're coming up on about 7 years ago.
Wow.
And a few months later was when I got let go and moved back to Idaho, which was critical. If that hadn't happened, Income School would have been a very slow thing. It might've even fizzled. But moving back allowed us to start working together one night a week. That was the beginning. And just over time, it turned into, we had a system, we taught the system, we created our first niche site school, and then that turned into Project 24.
Awesome. What a journey. What a 7 year ride. I bet it's been amazing to kind of watch things evolve over that time period like that. That's awesome. And I mean, considering you were, you know, nervous 7 years ago about going on the podcast, I was checking out your YouTube channel prior to this and you've got like 11 million views now. So how things have changed.
Yeah, and I still like, it doesn't come as naturally to me as it ever did to Jim, but like I've had to learn certain skills and I've had to get over certain fears and build confidence. Yeah. And if I could do that, I think anybody out there can do that. And I think that should say something. And it is good. Jim and I came with complementary skill sets. I definitely am the follow through type, but, anyway, that I think is what made it.
Sounds like a good match. I mean, a similar kind of thing with me and my co-founder, Mark. We've got very complementary skill sets. Yeah. And I definitely don't think we would have built the business to where it is today on our own, like singular. It's definitely a partnership that helped that. And it sounds very similar for you guys.
Yeah, I think so.
But Jim has recently left now to go off and do his own things. Do you know what he's doing, like what he's up to or where that path now splits?
Yeah, so he called me a couple weeks ago and we just kind of caught up because since he left, I mean, we've both been doing our own thing, like just head down, get to work. But he called me up and we chatted for a little while just to catch up and, he's doing really well. So he's working on, we had our YouTube channel called Backfire. It was our firearms channel. It was built originally just as a test case. The idea was like, let's pick an industry that's going to be hard. You know, and it's like firearms. I mean, there's some headwinds definitely facing that industry, but it's something that where we live and, you know, given our just the way we grew up, like it's pretty common here. People shoot, people hunt, etc. And so we know a lot about it. We both like to shoot. So that's what we did. And it actually was really successful. So he took that. That was a piece of what he took when he left. He's building that brand, kind of morphing it a little bit into more of a kind of a brand for men, just more about just trying to become the version of yourself you want to be. That's kind of the direction it's going. But he's working on other projects. He's got a couple of other niche sites. He and his wife are both passionate about education. They've got three kids and they don't like a lot of things about sort of the traditional public school model. Yeah. So their kids have gone to various different private schools, but not all private schools are even really their thing. So they're working on a project down there in Utah, an education project, trying to basically get a school set up that will be what they want.
So basically, that's teaching them cool to become entrepreneurs, I imagine. They don't teach that in school.
No, they don't. In fact, they teach you how to be a really good employee. That's what they teach in school. And sometimes a manager.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. No, that's good. That's good backstory. And so we kind of know where you're at now and the history of the company. So I want to get into the kind of the meat of what I want to talk to you about today, which is what you guys are known for and what you guys are famous for. And I want to kind of ask you some questions about a couple of different topics, but I'll start with content, like how you guys structure your content. And you've got 7 years of experience of teaching this and building your own site. So like, you know, I consider you guys to be more than an expert in this area. But the one thing that fascinates me about the model that you guys teach is your keyword research. And I want to delve into that a little bit deeper. Because I know you don't use traditional keyword research tools. I guess just to start off with, how does that work? How do you, on a broad level, you know, not in the weeds, but on a broad level, how do you do your keyword research without that?
Yeah. So on a broad level, I mean, for one, and I think it really does kind of help change sort of the paradigm is we don't call it keyword research. To us, it's search analysis. And the reason for that is the model of keywords is kind of based upon old search. You know, Google's not really basing search results off of specific words. They're basing it off of a search and the meaning of the search, the semantic meaning of the search. And so, you know, semantically equivalent searches can yield the same search results, even if they use different words. And so our whole concept is built off of search queries and topics. And so that's kind of the start, is we're looking for search queries that people are likely to be searching. And so in the beginning, we would let Google sort of tell us what those were. We would let Google auto-suggest things. So you might start with a word, a keyword that's, you know, from the industry. If I were to, if I had a site on cycling, you could start with the word cycling or bicycle, but that's going to give you really high level search queries, right? And so then I might take that down a little bit, kind of niche down to, you know, like road cycling or even something around bicycle parts, you know, bike frames, and then kind of let Google auto suggest, fill in the blank, you know, type in the letter A next and see what search phrase Google provides. And that used to be a really powerful tool because you could use Boolean operators like an asterisk to tell Google, hey, fill in the blank here. Google's kind of been deprecating the Boolean operators. And so that's become less powerful. It feels like they kind of caught on that people were doing that. And originally it was like, hey, the top things that show up are probably the highest searched things. Because those are the things Google assumes you're probably trying to search for. So anyway, that was an effective method to figure out what things are people searching. We don't know the exact volumes, but we kind of group it into buckets, right? So we have a model sort of, we call it the inverted pyramid. It doesn't, I think it's funny. It doesn't really have to be inverted. It can be right side up too. And the analogy holds, but basically the concept is, in any niche, there are entry level search queries that people are going to search, even if they don't do the thing that they're searching about, even if they just want to know about it, they have a passing interest. And there are a lot of search queries in that area. Well, those are going to be searched the most. Yeah. And then further down, this inverted pyramid, there's those search queries that are only going to be searched by the people that are doing that thing. But most people that do that thing, like most people that do cycling races, like that race bicycles, most of those people are probably going to perform this search at some point. So those are searched less frequently, but still reasonably often. And then you go down toward the tip and you have these search queries that are just, you know, they're very specific. You know, I want to be in the Tour de France. Like these are the types of search queries, right? Very specific, that are just going to be searched infrequently. And so it's just kind of a mental game. And then the next question is just how big is the pyramid? How popular is, you know, cycling in races? Like, how many people are doing that? And of that many people, how many of them are using the internet to do their searches? And we're not looking for exact numbers, but it's just kind of a thought exercise. And so that alone can really give us a pretty good idea. It just mentally, just even kind of a gut feel, people are going to be searching this thing. And that coupled with, you know, I mentioned Google Auto Suggest, but you know, that's maybe not as effective anymore. So now we use, like Google has their People Also Ask. So we can type in a search query that we thought of or that was maybe given to us by, you know, there's all sorts of these tools. There's the keyword cheater. There's a few others. There's several of them where it's like, you know, cycling, just give me a whole list of search queries, a ton of them. And we start with the ones that seem to make sense. And you can actually do that search, or you can do a partial search. So like, how many bicycles enter? Just only do the partial search. And then Google comes back and is like, I don't quite know what you're asking, but here are other questions people ask that are similar to that. And so it's the same idea. Google's kind of giving us, okay, these are things people are asking. These are the most common questions about how many bicycles. And so with that, we're just getting all these ideas. And if Google's handing them to us, they probably have search volume. We apply our own mental, like, just knowledge to that. It's kind of obvious sometimes that, okay, really, nobody's searching for that. And we kind of put these into buckets. And then when we pair that with the competition for that search query, then between the competition and sort of the likely search volume bucket, we just kind of get an idea of, should I write this or should I not? So it's a little bit less numerical than most methods. But when it comes to the traditional tools, I guess it's probably worth it to address this and why we just generally don't use them or promote the use of them. And that is really, it's two things. The first one is search volume numbers can only be so accurate. Most of the tools are using basically just clickstream data. They get a sampling, and a sampling is usually really accurate for kind of the middle of the bell curve, meaning those search queries that are searched all the time. What is the weather today? I think they have a pretty good idea of how many people search that because it's searched so much, the sample is going to accurately represent that. But the further you go out on the long tails, the less accurate the sample is going to be. And so we have written articles that said there's zero search volume across all the tools. They say zero search volume. And yet we get 5,000 organic page views a month. And so how is that happening? Well, we rank for tangential searches, like numerous other things, but also the original search query actually has some search volume. It's just the way we worded it in the tool or something, or, you know, just the tool's knowledge. It just didn't find that. And so, basically the danger is the tools are going to tell you not to write things. More often than not, they're going to tell you not to write things that you probably should have. And then the other issue with the tools is even if it's accurate, because of the tangential searches, and we can't think ahead of time of what are all the things this article might rank for, you might walk away with the impression that the most this article could ever get is 500 page views a month, because that's if I got all the people searching it. It's not worth my time. Well, no, that article is probably going to rank for 12 other things or versions of that question and other questions as well. And so the issue that I take isn't with the tools. I actually think that there are a lot of things they do that are really helpful. My issue is that most people, when they use the tools, become so reliant on the number, they can't shut off the number or put the number in context. And so we just tell people, just don't, you know. I do think that there's a chance that the next time that I go through the blogging course and just revamp it, which is hopefully in this coming year, we just did it this year, but I have so many things I want to tweak. I do think that there's a chance that what we'll probably do is have kind of an advanced search analysis module that people should take later on that helps them to do all the things we teach, but helps them to do it faster and easier using the tools, because now they have an intuitive understanding. But I think there's a lot of value in sort of doing it the manual way for a while first. So there's my long spiel about keyword research, but that's our process. And that's kind of our reasoning for why.
No, that's great. That's really insightful. Thank you very much. There's a great example, which I always reference for the different, you mentioned at the start, like about keywords being, you can't just rely on a keyword anymore. You have to rely on a topic. And the one I always use is like two searches. One is best golf balls for seniors and best golf balls for old people.
Right.
You put them both into a keyword research tool. They both have different keyword difficulty scores, different search volume. But if you Google both phrases, the results are the same. I mean, Google just sees them as the same. And people can run into problems if they just think about it on a keyword level. Because in that case, you might write two pieces of content that end up competing with each other. They'll never rank, things like that.
You know, it's been that way for a while, but it's only getting more that way, right? So, so BERT took things a step further. And then now, you know, Google's taking it. They're saying that they're like 10 times more better at that now than they were even with BERT. But I remember even probably 3 years ago looking at another example, which was like, I can't remember what it was. It was like niche site tutorial, niche site course, niche site. Like there were like a whole bunch of different words you changed. Like, okay, tutorial and course aren't quite the same thing. But our article ranked for both, number one, as well as about five others that were all slightly different nuances of learning how to make a niche site, you know? And so, again, if you're relying solely on the keyword, then you make those kinds of errors we talked about.
For sure. No, agreed. Sounds like our part of our research method is very similar. We also use a lot of the people also ask questions, even if they don't have a ton of search volume or even sometimes none, because I mean, the theory is if it's in a people also ask, then Google thinks it's important.
Right.
Obviously.
Yep. Yeah. And I would say sometimes, like, intuitively, you're going to know, okay, yeah, people are also asking that, but it's probably not frequently asked. That's okay. Yeah. I'm going to answer that question as part of an article so that this article can rank for that too. And so we don't always write a whole article on every one of those topics, but we definitely want to cover the content somewhere.
Well, that was the next thing I was going to ask you is how do you decide what, when you say you bucket them together, like, and cluster them together, how you decide what goes into a, you know, another piece of content or what becomes a standalone piece? So we've got our own theory and our own method, but I'm keen to hear how you figure that bit part out.
Yeah. Really in our sort of search analysis methodology, we actually have like a Google spreadsheet that, you know, our members can, like I mentioned, they can kind of put these things into volume buckets. One of the things we use is to help with estimating volume is Google Trends. And basically what we find is if you type in a search query, first of all, Trends doesn't use the same semantic capabilities that Google Search does. So if you word it differently, you will get a different result in Trends.
Okay.
And so if you type in a search query in Trends, oftentimes you'll see zero data because that exact search query is, or even very similar search queries aren't searched enough to give them much of a trend. But then if you reword it, make it just a little broader or something, then all of a sudden data starts to pop up. And what we found is if you've put something into Google Trends and it just fills in all the data, right? They've got their chart, they got, other related things, they've got geographies, et cetera, then there's the search volume is high. There's probably at least 10,000 people searching this every single month. That's just based upon our own analytics data for just hundreds of different searches that we've used. If the data is partial, there's some data that's shown, maybe the chart has a little bit on it, but it's not filled in, then it's going to be somewhere in about the 5,000 to 10,000 range. That's our estimate. Yeah. If there's none, then it's below 5,000. The problem with that, using that tool exclusively, is there are a lot of search queries under 5,000 that I'm totally writing. But it's just kind of a way to kind of put some of those bigger search queries into buckets. So those ones, anything like that, I mean, I'm going to write a standalone article because the search volume really, if I estimate that the search volume's likely to be over 1,000 people a month, and really what that is we look at the search query and say, this is a reasonable question to be commonly asked. And the niche isn't so tiny. Like if my niche was like, tuba players who like to play the tuba while they wear lederhosen, you know, like that's going to be a tiny niche. My pyramid is tiny, right? Everything's tiny. But for most niches, if it's a reasonable question that most people in that niche will ask, then we kind of put it sort of in that mid range. And most of those, a lot of those are going to merit their own article. Anything that's kind of a little bit more of a niche question, like, you know, a smaller subset of people are going to ask that. Maybe not so specific, like, you know, I want to be in the Tour de France. So, you know, what's the application process or what sort of prerequisites do I need? That's going to be searched very small, but even other things like, if I'm into road cycling and racing, pretty much everybody's going to need to figure out at some point, like, what do I do? Like, how do you handle getting a flat in the middle of a race? Like, what stuff do I need? Like, I need to know that, like, even non-racers, right? If I just go out on a road bike, especially, like, how do I handle a flat when I'm out on a ride? What's the best way to deal with that? Especially because I learned this when I got a road bike a few years ago. I grew up riding mountain bikes and you pressurize those tires to like 30, 40, maybe 50 pounds per square inch.
Yeah.
And road bikes, it's like 110. And so with tiny hand pump, like, forget it. It's not happening. Yeah. Like you can limp home with a little hand pump. That it'll give you enough pressure to limp home, but you're not riding fast. Anyway, just a little side note, something I learned when I discovered that. Anyway, when we find these more niche things, maybe even more specific than that. Maybe I'm looking at specific models of bikes, and I'm looking for, you know, what's the best, you know, even like what's the right tire size for this bike, or something like that. Or it's so much smaller that it's like, that doesn't merit its own article. So what do I do? Well, something with the tire size or wheel size or something like that on a specific frame size or something. Well, for that, I'm going to include that piece of information in a table with all of the other bike frame sizes and the right wheel and tire size for those. And that table can show up in search. So the problem is it just depends so much on the type of query. If it would fit really well in just a list of kind of data, you know, what size bike tire type of thing, then yeah, put it in a data table and Google can find it in there. We find, we found some situations where there are hundreds of search queries where each one is searched relatively infrequently, but together they're searched a ton. And the site winning all of the searches is one article that was written 15 years ago by someone that has a big data table. There one in particular that stood out to us because we were in the shooting industry was about recoil. Someone had a table about how much recoil to expect from different calibers of rifles, different cartridges. And he just put together a big table. How's it? And he was winning all of the searches for that. Wow. And so, again, there are a lot of other situations where it's not really a data table thing. It's more like this is an independent query that someone would search, but just infrequently. So what do I do? Well, I'm going to include it with other similar queries, and we call that a query group. We try to identify several of them, and we write one article that has a subheading for each one. And within the subheading, we write what we call an answer target, which is basically our attempt at winning the Google snippet. And we put one of those answering each one of those questions within that section of the article. And so now we have the potential to win the snippet for each one of those search queries. So again, there's never a one size fits all. That's the problem is the web is just so many variables of different types of search queries, but that's the approach. Just find the right type of content and the right grouping based upon the queries.
That makes sense. Do you ever take, into consideration what Google is returning back? So one of the steps in our methods is to literally, once you have that list of questions, is to Google them, each one, and see if Google is showing a standalone piece of content versus is it part of a bigger piece. And we basically that guide us rather than trying to figure out, do we think it's got high search volume? Would this one be searched less? So it should be part of a bigger one. We add that in. Do you ever do that? Or is that part of the consideration sometimes?
It is, particularly with snippets, you know, what type of snippet is being returned. We don't do that like distinctly as part of our search analysis process. We do the search and see what Google returns, but usually that's more from a assessing the competition standpoint. That said, one of the things we do teach, though, is that, and this is where it's kind of hard, is like you do have to use your own intuition to some extent. Sometimes Google returns forum results because that's the only thing that's on the web that answers that query. But other times Google returns forum results because that's really what the searcher needs, you know?
Yeah.
So if the intent of the search is, hey, I want to know what other parents do in this situation. Like I don't care what one blogger says as much as I just kind of want to know what do all the parents think? And so a forum is probably a better search result. And Google might surface a blog post here and there, but Google's just kind of figuring that out. But other times we'll do a search that's very like, I'm looking for a factual response to a question, but the only results are forums. And so to me, that doesn't indicate, I shouldn't write this because Google's returning forums. To me, that indicates, oh man, there's probably not very much competition from other bloggers. And so I do think that that's a good approach. So I'm not disagreeing with that. I think that approach in conjunction with just using your brain and good intuition,
yeah.
I think can lead you to make some really, really good decisions about what to write and what not to. I think that's good.
Yeah. Agreed. I probably should have caveated that by saying if we find forums in there or Quora or something, then
yeah.
to us, that's a really good indication that even if it's nothing else, then there's no other results on the page, and that's a good indication we should probably write it.
Yes, it often is. Yeah.
I think Ben Adler's keyword chef tool actually is designed to pull out keywords that have those kinds of results on page one. So and loads of people nice. Seem to have success with that. So
yeah, I need to try his tool. I know I've heard about it. I'm familiar with him. I haven't met him, but I should. I need to try it out. He'll be at an affiliate gathering in the spring, so I'll have to meet him there.
Oh, I'm looking forward to meeting you there. We'll be there too.
Yep.
It's good to have that. Yeah.
It is.
Awesome. All right. So that's good. So I think that covers kind of most of my questions I had around the keyword research.
Okay.
The next part I want to talk about is like the type of content that you guys like to create. One of the questions that lots of people ask us as an agency is, you know, how much commercial versus informational content should I be creating? Should I be doing one more than the other? And again, we have our own thoughts, but I'm keen to hear how you handle that with your sites.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've since the beginning of Income School, and probably even before, some of this comes from Jim's experience. We've taken kind of an information first approach most of the time. In fact, we've probably added more commercial content in the last few years than we had before. We would take very much like just answer people's questions. And then the affiliate link is more of here's my helpful, I'm going to tell you what I've used and give you that as advice, but we're not writing direct product reviews trying to get a sale. We're answering a question and providing you with an affiliate link to the product we recommend. And that approach has worked really well. We've learned that there are ways that you can write more commercial content that are more effective. Interestingly enough, they still are usually very informational.
Yeah.
And so I would say, yeah, I think it's more and more and more important all the time. I mean, just the Google updates this year alone and last year have just slammed so many affiliate sites that, I mean, to me, it just seems pretty apparent that for commercial specific content, Google's going to surface the retailer, Amazon, etc., more often than not.
Yeah, agreed. And also the approach that you take with the affiliate content in the informational content allows you to go after stuff which you would never really be able to compete with.
Yeah.
Like a great one that comes to mind is like a hard niche like VPNs, for example. You're never really going to rank for the best VPN, but
right.
you could rank for an informational piece of content where the answer to the question is you need a VPN, but the user doesn't maybe know that when they search for that. And then they read your article and it turns out they need a VPN and here's our recommendation. So it allows you to go after, I think, a lot more stuff which you would traditionally just bypass thinking that's way too competitive for us.
Yeah. And, something that I think maybe people don't talk about a lot is affiliate marketing within like info products, right?
Yeah.
Most of our commissions for hosting, for example, hosting is one of the like best affiliate opportunities for people who teach blogging, right? And so everybody pitches their host because they all pay really well. And it's funny because some people say, well, the only reason anybody recommends this host is because they have the highest commission. It's like, actually, no, this one pays more, but I still like this one better. So that's why I recommend them. They all pay really, really well. But we don't make most of our commissions because we have links in articles or we talk about them on YouTube. Most of those commissions come because somebody joins Project 24, our membership, and they start learning how to create a blog. And one of the first steps is you need a website. And if they didn't already have one, then we say, this is how to set up your hosting. And we walk them through step by step how to do it. And we say, this is also our recommendation. And if you use that recommendation, that's what we're going to show you. So as you walk through it, you're going to get that. And so, anyway, if info products is a part of someone's monetization strategy, affiliate marketing within that, especially when that affiliate product like is the solution to one of their problems, then that it's a great way to make some great affiliate commissions.
Cool. No, that makes total sense. Yeah. It's like a natural fit then, isn't it?
Perfectly. Yep.
Okay. So I guess creating mostly informational kind of content, do you have a specifically like a favorite type of content or a type of content that you feel works best? You know, is that like a listicle? Is that a Q&A? Do you have a go-to where you think, if I'm going to start a site, I'm going to fill it with this type of content first because I know it works the best?
You know, when we start a site, typically what we do is the first several blog posts we write, we're going to find specific search queries that merit their own article. So not the really tiny ones, but that are still kind of long tail, low competition. We call those response posts because the whole article is just a response to a search query. And so, and our format for that is like, brief introduction. We write an answer target, try to win a snippet. Usually that's just in the paragraph form for this type of post. Sometimes it might be a list or a small table, but oftentimes it's a paragraph.
Yeah.
A little bit of a segue, and then we'll usually have 3 to 5 segments, subheadings that each kind of dives into one piece and sort of answers that question as completely as we can, usually in about 1,000 words or so. And that format works really well to get those first articles ranking simply because you're talking low competition, a thorough answer to one specific question. And so we really like those, but that's kind of like, step one, right? From there, we also like to write a lot of more involved posts. And so I don't know that I have a favorite. We do, listicle is one of them. And there are a lot of times where like, that's just the best type of article for the type of search. And they can win a lot of searches, right? You can write a listicle of just like, top things to do in some, small resort town in a specific place. But then you can also rank if you answer specific questions about the specific things to do. So if somebody's looking for one of them, you rank. I mean, they're just awesome in so many ways. So I do like those. Sometimes a product review. But again, when we do a product review, it's more like what the Wirecutter was really known for. We're going to do some testing, maybe some comparisons. I really like product comparisons, but I'm an advocate for if you're going to be reviewing products, you should probably have the product and not just, summarize what Amazon has to say about it, which was like the approach, by the way, for so long. And still is for some people. They haven't quite figured it out yet. We have several different formats. I like interviews, but I like using an interview as a supplement to a piece of content. I don't usually like an article that just the interview is the content. It doesn't meet a search very well. We like doing a lot of independent research of different kinds. So if we can do a survey, if we can, talk to an expert, anything like that, and so there are a lot of different formats. I would say that I really like the response post format. And then one of the formats we'll use for more involved posts is basically just the longer response post. But where you're responding usually to a primary search query, but also maybe a small query group as well of small queries within that. And those make up some of the subheadings. And so then that one article becomes more of a pillar piece of content. So really it's just, for me, my favorite thing to do is to pair the content type to the search query.
That makes a little sense. Yeah. We were having great success at the moment with the Q&A style and the listicles, especially if we can combine them. It's interesting you mentioned there about ranking for other terms. So we've recently done, some content around, best X type of restaurant in certain cities. Mm-hmm. And what we're finding and looking in Search Console is that not only are we ranking for those terms, we're also ranking for like really random long tail stuff. Like, is X restaurant child friendly? And like, it's a listicle type, but we've mentioned that in there. So that's really good.
And like that query really wouldn't merit its own full blog post. I mean, it's like, am I going to write a whole blog post about all the reasons why it is or is not child friendly? You know, that feels like a stretch to try to get 1,000 words or more out about that.
Another thing which we found working really well at the moment is almost pairing the two together. So basically like starting with the listicles. So like big type of listicle articles, best X in whatever or whatever, but informational, obviously not commercial. And then running all of the primary terms for the list through the people also asked box to pull out all the questions. And we've got almost like two types of content. We've got like a list of the listicles, which are best restaurants in X, and then all of the related like question-based queries that Google tell us are related. And then the internal linking opportunities there is immense. And you just build a massive ton of relevance.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that's a really cool approach.
So I guess another thing I want to ask is about, because people ask us this all the time, and it ties in nicely to a video you guys done quite recently, I think, is what's a good number of posts? And it's a really open-ended question, but do you think Google needs to see like, you know, X number of posts before they start taking you seriously?
I think sort of, but the problem is that I don't think it's a firm number. So, and I know this one was probably like 4 years ago, but still Jim and I started a couple of websites. He started one in soundproofing and I started one just about kind of home security, but do it yourself. And I still didn't know very much back then. So this might have been more like 6 years ago. And both of those websites, we each wrote about 10 articles before we were kind of bored. now I think I could have written more, but I'm more of the like, in our business, I've always kind of been the one to take on kind of the minutiae, the finances and just a lot of the minutiae. And so I think for me, and I just was kind of busy, but soundproofing in your home, it was just not an exciting topic for Jim. I think he wrote 11 articles and that was it. Both of those websites had the articles, several of the articles ranking number one. It took a little longer maybe than usual, but the soundproofing website, we decided to do a giveaway on our channel. And the site was, I don't remember how old, and we had a few affiliate links here and there. And it was making like $350 a month on Amazon. The traffic was not bad for, I can't remember what it was, but for 11 articles, I mean. And so Google had picked it up, even though it only had 11. And same thing with the house security one. We ended up rolling those articles into another website later that we built, that we sold. But in both cases, the content itself did fine. But I think it was because we had picked like pretty low competition searches. I mean, there just wasn't much out there. And so when Google has very little to pick from, they're going to surface what they have. That might be a little harder today than it was even 4 years ago, 5 years ago. But I do think it's still possible sometimes. So what's my number? We usually have said, and we have for several years, but like, I'm really not going to slow down at all publishing until I have at least 30. And we've used that number a lot. And I don't know that it's a magic number. It seems to work pretty well, though. If somebody can get 30 decent blog posts out, then if they start to kind of slow down a little bit on their publishing routine, it seems to be enough to get some velocity from Google to get them to start taking notice. But I don't stop on a website usually till at least 100. I'm not the one to always go put 1,000 blog posts on every site and just write about everything, but I still want to have a lot of opportunities for people to find us.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense. And I guess a follow on to that is, do you think content velocity is important? Like when you're creating that content, do you think it matters if you put all that, you know, 100 pieces of content on the site day one? Or do you think it's an important factor that it's spread out over, you know, 2 a week, 3 a week, or whatever that is?
From what we've seen, and this is interesting, on a podcast I heard a few years ago, I think it was one of the guys from Authority Hacker who mentioned, like, we just put them all on the site and Google doesn't seem to care. Like, if I order a batch of content, I publish it all at once. I want it getting indexed as quickly as possible. we at the time already kind of had that philosophy. We're just going to publish as fast as we can in the beginning. We've done it. We've tested it. We've done literally 50 and even 100 articles at once. Just, you know, we have our own, we have our own writers. And so it's just, you know, boom, here's 100 and just go.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know that that harms it versus dripping it out over time. If anything, it's nice that, you know, Google can index it all. There's, I think there's maybe two issues that I have with just sort of content velocity. The first one is if you're way too slow, I have seen that hamper a site. I've seen sites where it took them a year to get the first 10 articles out and just none of them ever got anywhere versus like, oh, I wrote 10 in the first 15 days or the first month. And some of them actually did get picked up and ranked. You know, that is a problem. The other is, I think if, when you do dump 100 at once, then when Google comes to crawl the site, if you don't have, like, if you're on the cheapest servers you can get on, you know, John Mueller said this in a video, and I don't know totally what I think about it. Like, how hard is it, you know, for a server to handle the bots crawling a whole site if it has 100 posts? Yeah. Blogs are like are very small and simple compared to some of the sites that John's talking about. So, yeah. But I could see potentially if you're on ultra cheap hosting, and Google's bots are like clicking every single link, trying to spider your whole site at once. I could see it causing it to, you know, what he says is basically, if your site starts to lag and have trouble because of what they're doing, then they'll stop and then your site will get recrawled later. And that could slow you down. So I don't know if that has any real merit for bloggers. But that might potentially, if you put 100 articles on a site all at once, they might not actually all get indexed as quickly as they would. But at the same time, all 100 are there. So they're still potentially getting indexed faster than if you dripped them. So I don't know how I feel totally about it. I don't know that there's anything to having a publishing schedule. I always publish 3 a week forever. We found that when we write evergreen content, it doesn't really matter. We can go years without publishing on a site and not lose traffic. We'll revamp some of the content over time, but we can just leave it and it's fine. Whereas we do YouTube, and on YouTube, that is the complete opposite. It is all about consistency and publishing. So, that's one of the things I love about blogging is you really can like take a break and it's okay.
Yeah. Interesting about the, you mentioned about the crawl data there.
Well,
one of the things that we use a lot in Niche Website Builders is using expired domains or aged domains. Mm-hmm. And you can actually see the crawl data and basically the, how much crawl, budget Google will give you in Search Console. And it's always way high. Well, it's obviously going to be way higher with an aged domain. So we find getting like, you know, 100, well, I think we launched a site this week with 135 pieces of content, and I've got no qualms in my mind that it's going to get indexed fairly quickly because of that. I think the other thing which is important on that whole indexing thing is like both site structure and internal linking. Like we design our sites in a very specific way. We make custom category pages, so you don't have, I never know what to say this word. Is it pagination or pagination?
I pronounce it pagination, but I'm not one of those people that's too picky about pronunciation. My wife has a very big vocabulary, but a lot of it she learned from reading. And so sometimes I'll say a word. She's like, what is that? And I'm like, it's this. And I'll write it out. She's like, oh, I know that word. I'm like, yeah, this is how people say it though. But she learns it because she reads a ton. So, you know, if somebody pronounces something quote wrong, I don't care because it means they probably learned it from reading.
Yeah, good. Well, I never know how to say it. So we have our custom category pages where there's no pagination, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it's all on one page. Okay. And that allows like a really low click depth, essentially. So nothing is ever more than 2 or 3 clicks away from the homepage, which I think is important. And then obviously the internal linking. Like for the more links you can add, the easier it allows the Google bot to come and crawl the site. So,
absolutely. That's one thing that I think we teach it in our in our blogging course. We teach, you know, internal linking and structure. I feel like we need to teach it better and earlier. I want to include structure at the search analysis phase. Right now it's not, it's a little bit later. And the internal linking I think is really important. But on our own sites, we often, you know, we do our search analysis, we say, we send them off, we have our writers write the articles. They write the articles independently of each other. And then we get them back and they're published. And I'm like, well, shoot, we really need to do a good job of internal linking from the start because it helps with indexing, but it also I think is really important for just from an SEO standpoint and from a usability standpoint.
Yeah, agreed. Well, I mean, I still had tons more questions to ask you, but we're coming up on almost an hour now, which means we've done a good job in covering things in detail. So I'm just going to fly through these next parts.
Perfect.
If you don't mind.
The next one
is link building. I know you guys have never been a big advocate of that. Is that still the same? Is it going to change? Just quick overview on your thoughts on that.
Quickly, I would say link building for the express purpose of getting links is the thing that we don't advocate simply because it's easy to get into the whole trying to game to game Google and pushing it a little bit too far that way. What we do is we just call it like, I can't even remember the terminology we usually use now for some reason, it's just linked, but it's kind of just like marketing to our industry. So, being on a podcast, you're going to get a link. You write a good organic, good content organically gets a lot of links. But, you know, we're not out there trying to pitch to massive websites, oftentimes that aren't really that relevant to our niche, trying to get a link just because they have a high authority or authoritativeness that we don't advocate for. So, but links are good. We just want them to be natural contextual links as much as possible. And we will reach out to get them, but usually it's more through some sort of collaboration or something like that.
That makes sense. Yeah. So basically not link building for the sake of link building.
Right.
More offering a ton of value to get that link.
Right. And frankly, usually in that sense, the link is more natural and it comes with a more natural pitch for the site. And so anybody that's consuming that content has a greater reason to actually follow the link and come to the site. Yeah. So it's more of an industry outreach is what we call it. Just reaching out to others within our niche.
That makes sense. Okay. Next, I want to ask you about is expired domains. Like, have you tried building on them? What are your thoughts? We love them at Niche Website Builder, so always keen to hear what other people think.
Yeah. It's not something I've given a lot of priority to. I think that long-term, whether you use one or not, long-term, your site's going to do what it does based on the content that it has. But what I've seen from some case studies recently from people like you guys and others, Carl talks about them quite a bit too, is that it can give you a pretty nice head start. And so it's something that I'd be willing to look at. For me, I like to pick a domain that is, I don't know, that I kind of like and that I feel like it's kind of brandable, because to me, even if I start something as a niche site, like the potential to become an authority, I think is there. And so, so if I could find an expired domain that I liked and that I felt like was going to be a good brand to create and build up, I would totally be open to trying it. But it's not something we openly teach and advocate yet. It's something I definitely want to test out though, because I do think there's some merit to it.
Yeah, that's part of the hard part is finding a brandable one. Like you're kind of stuck with if the metrics are good and the niche is good, then you kind of got to live with the name then sometimes.
Exactly. That's the trade-off, I think.
Yeah. And I think the other part you mentioned there is quite important to mention is that expired domains basically give you a head start. They're not a magic bullet. They're not like this secret weapon. They can give you a really good head start, but ultimately over the duration, like you have to put in the same effort. You have to put in the same time, the same content and everything. Everything's the same. You just get a slight head start basically.
Right. But I mean, if you can get your content, like you said, you have that higher crawl budget, some initial trust already from Google, then if you can get your content indexed 3 to 6 months faster, that's a pretty awesome head start. So I can see the merit in it. I just want to try it out a bit.
Well, I mean, I'll chat to you about this offline, but if you want any advice or help vetting a domain, more than happy to help you out with that.
I'd appreciate it.
Okay. I mean, that's great. I think we've covered pretty much everything I wanted to chat about. I think lots of the stuff we've talked about here is covered in more depth in your Project 24 course. Do you want to tell people a little bit more about that, where, like, you know, where they can find out more, what's covered, how it works, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, Project 24 is pretty easy to find. Even if you just go to IncomeSchool.com, the homepage, it's kind of made to direct people to it. But IncomeSchool.com/Project24. But basically, though, here's what it is. It's a membership. It is an annual subscription. The first year costs more than the other years. We found that if the entry is too low, we get so many people trying to scam. They'll come in, they'll record all the videos, they'll leave, they'll even ask for a refund, giving some, you know, excuse. And there's so many, like, yeah, anyway, there's so many probably virus filled like versions that you can download of some of the videos. Yeah. Most of them are outdated because it's constantly updated. But anyway, so that's the model that we use. So it's annual, but the reason for that is it is filled with course content. We have our whole blogging system just laid out for exactly start to finish. If you're just like just getting started and don't even know how to start a site, or if you already have that, that's fine. You can skip that portion because we're going to teach you how to do our search analysis, how to write and craft your content in the way that we do, how to monetize it, internal linking, etc., all of that stuff. And then even how we're going to reevaluate that content in the future to determine, you know, what content should be updated and what content maybe should kind of be abandoned, etc. We also cover YouTube. The idea is we're all about internet marketing and making an income online. We actually just launched our YouTube system. It's really, really in-depth. I've never seen anything like this. We had a course on YouTube before that was good and very helpful, but for anybody that is interested in YouTube, Nate from Channel Makers, he's the driver behind this. His YouTube channel is called Channel Makers. We're partners. I mean, he works here. We work together. Anyway, so that's a big part of it. Tons of course content, email marketing, etc. It's all there. Then we have a community. We host it on Discourse. It's a private community only for members. It's very, very, very active. People ask and get answers to very technical questions. People get feedback on their content. People get answers to more strategic questions. People that are at a stage where they are wanting to try some really advanced things because they're already making great income, and now they're trying to, you know, take it from, you know, 4,000 a month to 10 or 30,000 a month in some cases. They're there as well, asking questions and helping each other. And we have members who say, I'll always be a member, even if I only use the community, because of the value that you get from that. We do masterminds. We have a few every single week where it's a Zoom call. And members can just call in, and one of us from the team, me or somebody else from the team, is there. Oftentimes there's a specific topic. Other times it's a general Q&A. And the idea is, again, you get to know other members, you get to ask all of your questions, get clarity. We have some resources, our WordPress theme Acabado, which is, I think, a good theme if you're a beginner and don't want to deal with much technical stuff. There are plenty of other WordPress themes that I love. So I in no way want to tell people this is the one every blogger has to use, but we provide that. That's free for members. There's a lot of those kinds of resources as well. We're about to launch just an affiliate marketing plugin that just kind of does all the things that we would want an affiliate marketing plugin to do. And that's going to be available to members. Anyway, anything and everything that we've ever taught or done, it's all in there. We have a podcast as well, one for blogging, one for YouTube, that's only available to members. We just try to pack it with all the value we can. There's no upsells inside. That's Project 24. It's just trying to be everything that you'll need, short of, you know, like handing you free content. Like that's the one thing we don't do.
It sounds so full of value, to be honest. Everything in there. Yeah. I think the one part you mentioned there, which is super important, is the community. I mean, I still don't have friends who understand what I do. My wife doesn't really understand what I do. Like it's hard to talk to people like in your general day-to-day life about this stuff, especially, and there's no way you could ask them for advice or run ideas by them or brainstorm with them. So right. having that community, I think, is super powerful.
I think you're right. I hear that all the time. I experienced it and still do all the time. And so anytime you can have somebody to bounce things off of and even just to commiserate with, like, hey, this is hard, you know, the first several months of a new blog is hard. And if you've never done it before, you're afraid you're going to fail. And having somebody to say, hey, you know what? I was right there 6 months ago and this is where I am now. That's just so motivating.
Yeah, for sure. It's one thing I always tell, whenever I have calls with customers or potential customers, I'm like, if this is your first time going through this, like that whole journey, like the J curve of spending or investing money or investing time, I'm not seeing any return. If it's the first time, it's so hard to go through. Yep. But if you've got people around you who've already done it, it's easier to stomach.
It is. I have no trouble with it now. I can start a blog and I don't even care. It's like, yeah, I know that's going to happen. That's fine. Yeah. Because I know where it ends up. If you're first time, that confidence is not there. I've been there. I experienced it myself too.
Awesome. Well, Ricky, this has been great. I've learned a ton. I think our audience and our listeners will probably learn a ton too. Is the website the best way to get in touch with you, or how's the best way to follow what you're doing? Is YouTube, website?
Yeah, the YouTube channel is probably the best. On the website, it'll direct you everywhere. It'll direct you to, to our YouTube channel. But YouTube is where we're most active. It's just Income School. It's the name of the channel. Or if you're into YouTube or want to get into YouTube, Channel Makers is the other. But that's where we are. And we're publishing at least once a week, something new, talking about internet marketing.
Awesome. Great. Well, thanks for being a guest. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And have a good Christmas. Have a good holiday.
Thanks. You too.
Cheers, Ricky. Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you're listening to the podcast version of this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please rate and review, as this will allow us to grow our audience and create more shows like this one. If you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to the channel and click on the bell to be the first to know about any new episodes that we release. Until the next episode, goodbye.